episode 17 of the Fighter Pilot Professor. Super excited. Today we're going to talk about the spectrum of conflict, right? And we're also going to dive into a little discussion about accountability, both holding people accountable and being accountable as a leader. So hope you enjoy, and we'll jump right in. So a question recently came to me, actually, from my mother-in-law. So thanks, Nancy. Appreciate it. About, like, do we call what's happening in Israel or in other places a war? Or what is it? How do you define it, right? And her question stems a lot from, what I would call, like, a Western world idea of how war and peace exist, right? And I talked a little bit about this in some earlier episodes, but in general, right, in the Western world, we tend to see it as war or as peace, and then there's kind of nothing in between, right? So we're either at war or we're not, right? But in reality, it's not war or peace. It's just some thing in between, right? You can see from this graph, right, like that despite what we might in the Western world, especially in Western Europe after the end of World War II, might define as times of peace, you can see that there are still conflicts or deaths by conflicts, at least that's what this graph depicts, deaths by conflicts all around the world. So what does that mean? Is there always wars going on? Yes, and not really, right? So maybe a better way to think of it is instead of war or peace is like a spectrum of conflict. And on the furthest, most dramatic end of the spectrum, we might find total global thermonuclear war, right? In other words, we're going to totally and utterly destroy a nation and just wipe it off the map. Right? That would be total, complete war. This is like very Clausewitzian ideas of war. On the farthest other end of the spectrum, we would find the idea of no war at all. Zero war anywhere in the world, total peace everywhere, right? Neither of those things have ever existed. So what that tells me is, and what Clausewitz argues as well, is that sort of there's always something going on in between, right? And so while we may be allies and partners with Great Britain, for example, that doesn't mean that we don't have disagreements, arguably conflicts, right? Now, obviously, we're not shooting at each other, right? But those conflicts can be diplomatic. Those conflicts can be economic, right? There's a whole other realm of conflict besides just the actual shooting war conflict, right? And then you have things like crime, and how does organized crime fit into this idea of conflict and war? And there's tons of writing about how does crime fit in, and where do like mercenaries come in, and like are like huge crime organizations like drug cartels, are they like pseudo states that have their own militaries, right? And if so, then is what they're doing against the countries that they're operating in, like Mexico, for example, is that a war? So how do we classify that, right? And so really we're just like on spectrums of conflict, right? And maybe one of the best ways to illustrate this is a conflict a couple of conflicts the United States participated in, Vietnam, Korea, and Afghanistan. And those conflicts, while the folks that the United States were mostly fighting against, the Koreans, the Vietnamese, and Afghans, they were fighting what might be considered a total war. In other words, they were harnessing like every bit of their society. They were willing to suffer high amounts of casualties to win their objectives, right? They were willing to go for as long as it took to be victorious, right? As a case, especially in the Vietnamese and the Afghans, 20 years, right? For the Afghans, 15 years for the Vietnamese, and even more than that, stretching all the way back to French colonial times, right, before that. So they were willing to pay the price to achieve their objectives. In the meantime, the United States was not willing to pay that same price. And while we brought to bear some of our most advanced military weapons, for example, we weren't willing to pay the ultimate price and just pour all of our economy, all of our people, all of the resources of our nation into fighting that war. So for them, it was a total war. For us, it was a war of limited objectives. So how do you reconcile that, right? It's just differences in opinions, for lack of a better way to put it, on how you see the war, right? And so even though you're fighting a war and people are fighting and dying and we're spending lots of money, it's not the entirety of the American capacity, right? And so, you know, things like World War II then in a way become aberrations where we harnessed, where nations harnessed much, much, much larger sections of their economy, much larger sections of their population through things like drafts to win wars with nearly unlimited objectives, right? Total defeat of Japan, total defeat of Germany. And instead, much more common are conflicts like we see between Israel and Hamas, for example, or maybe even Russia and Ukraine, even though that's a sure-on shooting war, right? And it's a much more extreme war for the Ukrainians. They're no longer arguably fighting for their total survival, right? Now it's just sort of broken down into the stalemate of who can outlast who. And arguably neither nation is pouring the entirety of their economic and political and population resources into that war. So as you can see, like, war doesn't really exist on peace or war, or peace or war, depending on how I did it earlier, right? But somewhere on the middle, right? It's a spectrum in the middle of conflict where different sides take on different motivations, different sides use different levels of their effort, etc., different amounts of their state, if you will, and they're willing to do what it takes to win the war. So you can sort of judge it a little differently than just war or peace when you look at it that way. Hope that helps, Nancy, and thanks for sending me your question. All right. As always, I get interesting questions from my students about being a future leader or being a leader. And you know, one of the things that is often a topic of debate is getting in trouble, right? Or what a better way to maybe think of it is accountability, right? And often we associate accountability with punishment. But I would offer that a good leader knows that accountability does not necessarily equal punishment, right? I can hold somebody accountable for their actions, and I can certainly punish them, right? If I'm a businessman, for example, I may fire somebody for stealing from me, right? That's a way of holding them accountable, right? But I also may not have to do that, right? Obviously, that's an extreme example, but I can hold people accountable in other ways, right? And as a leader, one of the main ways that I can hold people accountable is through learning, in my opinion. And what I mean by that is, like, unless they've done some sort of like massive like moral or ethical failure where they can no longer be a part of your organization, right? I'm assuming that for the most part, you're going to continue to hold that person in your organization even if they've made a mistake, right? Now, as a result of that, that means that you want them to learn, right? You don't want them to make this mistake anymore. And assuming that it's a mistake and not a crime, right? Or it's a mistake and not, they're not doing this intentionally, then I can hold them accountable by teaching them the proper way to do something, right? And so it falls on me as the leader then to say, hey man, that's not the way that you do this here in this organization. Let me show you how to do this, right? And this kind of goes back to some of the things we've talked about before about, you know, introduce, practice, and demonstrate proficiency along the way of doing things, right? People are in different levels of being able to demonstrate proficiency. And sometimes, depending on the skills of the person involved, right, they may be able to demonstrate proficiency one time and then later, not so much, right? And so when that happens, when they fall below that line of demonstrating proficiency, well, now I'm back in the practice or maybe even introduce area. And as a leader, then it falls on me to go, no, 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 this is how we do it here. This is the right way to do that thing, right? And then hopefully that builds them back up to a level of proficiency, right? Now, obviously, you can't do this forever, right? There is some expectation that eventually this person will be able to do the thing that you're asking them to do to a level of proficiency that you're asking them to perform it at, right? And that's when, right, it comes into play where you say, okay, now I'm going to have to hold you ultimately accountable and you can no longer work in this or be a part of this organization, right? Accountability also runs both ways as a leader, right? And often it's easy for us to just, as leaders, to just like make a mistake and everybody's like, well, the boss made a mistake and we breeze right by it, right? Nobody can or will hold you accountable. So you have to hold yourself accountable as a leader. And so how do I do that? Well, one way to do that is admitting that you made a mistake. Like, hey, gang, and it doesn't have to be like in some huge forum, right? But hey, man, I made a mistake. I'm really sorry that I did that. Here's how I'm going to get better at that thing, or here's what I'm going to do to help make up for that mistake, right? And so that's demonstrating to your subordinates that you are holding yourself accountable and you are holding yourself accountable to them for the things that you are supposed to do in the organization or they expect you to do as a leader. And when you fall down on that job, right, you say, hey, I've done this thing and here's what I'm going to do to fix it. In the same manner of, hey, you've done this thing, it's not up to my standard, here's what I want you to do to fix it. It's the same idea, right? Introduce practice, demonstrate proficiency. I have not demonstrated proficiency as a leader, and therefore I have to go back to the introduce phase where there's some learning to take place, right? So you may have to go back to books, right? You may have to go learn something new, learn a new skill, brush up on some sort of technology, whatever it is that you do, right? In order to get back to that level of proficiency that's expected of you as a leader. So I hope that helps. Hope that helps make you a better leader and helps hold the people around you accountable. And just as a note, in my opinion, right, if you as a leader are accountable through that mechanism, it makes holding other people accountable and it makes them feel less like they're in trouble and more like, hey, this is what we do in this organization. We make a mistake, we learn from our mistake, and we get better as a result. So there you go. Enjoy. Have a good one. All right. There we go. That's wrapping it up. Episode 17. The spectrum of conflict. That's a complicated idea. And it's not something that like we take easily here in the Western world. Or in peace, but the spectrum of conflict, it's neither war nor peace. It's kind of all everywhere, all the time. Right? So I hope you learned a little bit there. And then I hope you learned a little bit about how to be accountable, how to hold people accountable, and the importance of doing this. Have a good one.